Today, for Always Record, episode 156, we are releasing approximately the first 2 hours of our SyncBook Plus member hangout from April 20th. All of our member hangouts have been really amazing experiences for us. What makes this one special in the sense that I want to share it with you and the Always Record audience is that David Plate, whose absence from Always Record over the last few months has definitely been felt, he's definitely been missed, and we are very happy to have him join us for this member hangout, as well as Jason Barrera, and a slew of amazing voices from our member calls. Since there was so much David Plate in this one, and since I've so missed having him on Always Record, and frankly, just because it was a great conversation, I wanted to share this with all of you folks. So you're going to get about the first 2 hours here, and then the last hour or so I will be putting in the member section as the member call itself. All right, strap yourselves in. Let's go.
Hey, Alan, how are you?
I'm good. Everything good on your end?
Yeah, real good. No, I didn't know if there was multiple people there at first, so I was a little confused. And then I was also trying to stop this video that I was watching. So
gotcha. Yeah. Now I'm just starting to. I don't see Doug on yet. I was trying to wait a few minutes, but I'm just gonna start adding people in now.
Sounds good.
Hey.
Hey, what's going on, man?
How am I coming through?
You sound good. You sound good.
Okay.
You sound like Misty has a sore throat.
A little one, yeah. Honestly, I really do because I'm feeling better now, but I woke up at about 2 in the morning last night, just sick, and I just was throwing up for about 10 hours straight. It was really terrible.
Say throwing up for 10 hours straight?
Yeah, like once every 20 minutes or so.
Oh, God.
So I'm a little exhausted, but all I have to do is put my headphones on and chime in occasionally here. So I figured I would join you guys.
Cool. Well, talk amongst yourselves for a few minutes if you so desire. You could talk about puking if you want. I'm just trying to...
No, I'm glad you're better, John.
How are you, Dennis? It's been a while.
I'm good, yeah. I'm real good. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, you too. You guys have been doing great work with the Bizarro Always Record, by the way.
It's been fun.
I've talked to you since you... Yeah.
It's been fun. Those are good... I mean, I don't know. It's kind of fun recreating. You basically throw the ball out, have some ongoing email chats, and just kick it around. It's pretty low stress.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But, I mean... You guys gel together very well, and you'll have an enthusiasm and you share the same sort of passion for your subjects, and there's never, there doesn't seem to be a time when there's nothing to be said.
It's time in.
So that's
holy crap. There's plenty to talk about.
And that's really important in any sort of like radio format. So all the members can hold their own, and you guys can all hold your own. So that's very good.
But it's fun.
Hello.
Oh.
Hey. Yep. Go on, Dennis.
Oh, it's just...
Hello?
It's neat to see David on this
call. I don't know if you guys can hear me, but...
Doing a few episodes just makes you think, like, how did those guys do so many? Like, it's just...
I know, it's wild.
Do it. Hey, David. We can hear you, David.
Yeah, whoever... That was David?
I think it was David Blake, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, we can hear you, David.
I know,
and generally my episodes were never epic necessarily, not like 4 or 5 or 6 hour ones.
Well, yeah, they did. Yeah. You included. I didn't mean to not include you in that, but like, that's 150 or I don't know. It's a lot. It's a lot of conversations.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Have you guys talked since the last one, or are you planning on doing another?
Yeah, actually, we were just, we've been talking, and we were just organizing, getting our schedules together for another one, so.
Yeah, I know Alex is, he moved recently and he started a new job and he's yeah. home for some family stuff. So he's been, I know yeah. he's been very tied up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And hey, Jason, I don't know if you can hear me. I saw you just came on Skype. I don't know if Doug had emailed you or not.
Yes, I can hear you, if you can hear me.
Hi.
Hey, Jason.
Hey, everybody.
Hey,
David.
Hi. Hey, Missy.
We got a lot of people on this call right now.
This is a pseudo Misty. This isn't actually the real Misty.
Oh, it's
she'll be here later, but for now it's just me.
Oh, well, maybe that was Hannah. That was probably Hannah.
That was probably him.
Yeah, that was me.
Hey guys, what's the story, Morning Glory?
That's so weird that you would say that, because before this call I took a shower and for some reason Wonderwall popped into my head.
I was just talking about it day before yesterday, and it wasn't really like consciously just saying that, but I said that. Yeah, that's weird. Because it was the whole thing that they said that they were bigger than the Beatles. Because the Beatles said that they were bigger than Jesus, and so they're like, oh, we're the Beatles bigger than Jesus, and we're bigger than the Beatles. They're a bunch of assholes, but yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Has anyone ever seen the Wonderwall movie? Not the band, but like the movie from like the 60s? I think I need to make it my project in the next... in my next life or my or more sooner than that to find it.
You didn't say that.
What's the premise of it?
The only thing I know about it, so basically, like, obviously, like, oh wait, you mentioned Oasis saying bigger than the Beatles, they ripped off, like, they basically were like, hey, we'll just pretend to be the Beatles or whatever.
Oh shit, it's with Jane Birkin.
So, Wonderwall was a movie George Harrison did the score to, and, like, helped with, like, the art design and different stuff like that, so I always assumed that that was Oasis's reference there.
Jane Birkin is Penny Lane. You know who Jane Birkin was? She was with Serge Gainsbourg. So Charlotte Gainsbourg is the daughter of Jane Birkin, I believe. Because it was later in his life. Yeah, crazy. So you know Charlotte Gainsbourg, Nymphomaniac, and Melancholia, and Antichrist.
Nymphomaniac was surprisingly good. Because, that, I mean... superficially, it's like, oh, what the fuck is this? But it's quite good. Quite good.
Yeah, I don't... David, if you're looking at it, maybe you can tell us something about the details of the movie. I just know...
The soundtrack was composed by Beatle George Harrison, whom saw approached specifically for the project. Harrison had never done a film soundtrack and told Masao... I don't know how to say the name, Masao... he did not know how to do it, but when Masao promised to use whatever Harrison created, Harrison took the job. Cool. Is there a focus, or what is this? Is this what's happening? I got a phone call.
Yeah, you know, the focus is what you got. No, I don't know. I saw you were online. I just added you to the call. We've tried to add you in before, but this is our monthly member hangout call. And...
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah, I just didn't know what was happening. I was like, is this like an always record with like an extra lot of people or what's... Oh, so this
That's
is...
essentially what it is. That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
So what's the if you had to describe the premise of Always Record, what would you say?
I did describe the premise of Always Record, and I believe it ended up somewhere as a description.
Yeah, okay, that's true. Hey, well, Kaylee, I don't necessarily want to put you on the spot here, but we have the unique opportunity of having both David and Jason here. Did you have a question you wanted to ask David, or is that, like I said, if that's not something you're prepared to ask at the moment, just...
I could ask that. I was actually messaged Jason earlier to see if he was going to be on this call, because I would like to pose this question to him as well. Can you guys hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I guess I've been making a gigantic drawing, basically, which is sort of just like a map of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, with mostly correspondences from Crowley's 777, but then also some of Israel Gardy's, which, I mean, a lot of them coincide, but I've gotten to a point where I'm basically at the top of the tree and I'm having a difficult time figuring out, I guess, the planetary correspondences.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I actually, before this, Paul, hoping that I would get a chance to ask this question, I sort of, like, made notes about different versions that I had seen of this, and so it seems like this sort of, I don't know, like this weird rotation of Pluto, Uranus, and Neptune. And there was even one where, like, Saturn was not in Dina, it was somewhere else. And I'm hesitant to... not necessarily finish this thing, but to maybe even just like identify what resonates with me the most, because it seems like these planetary symbols are sort of like interchangeable in a way, and I guess I wanted to get both of your perspectives on I don't know, perhaps like different systems of labeling those planets in the specific spheres. Do you guys?
Yes, I'm listening. Jason, do you want to take it?
Well, it seems like anything beyond Saturn is going to be pretty much just a modern invention.
Hmm.
Now, I think David might be able to more detail like the different versions of the Sefer Yetzirah, where don't they have like different planetary attributions for some of them?
Right. So
it's kind of confusing.
There's been multiple changes over time, and what's crazy is I'm literally looking at a prophecy that's describing in the future from the second century what's going to happen with the tree and how to tell if it's correct or not. And so there's a number of things. Like if you're talking about the pathways and the 22 letters, you're talking about the Sefirot. So everything has been changed, but the changes are specific. So if you look at the Ramach and what his associations were, he has Gevurah not as Mars but as the sun, and he has Chesed not as Jupiter but as the moon. And so those were switched. So you have Yesod would be the moon now, right, in the Golden Dawn system, and then Mars would be Gevurah. So, but it's very interesting that, like, Tiferet's the sun, it gets switched with Gevurah. Chesed is Jupiter, it gets switched with Yesod. What they're connecting, apparently. There's the diagonal pathways is the key to know if it's been decoded correctly. So if you add up the geometrical values of the pathways that are diagonal on the Tree of Life, you'll get, if you add up all 12, you get 865. If you are looking at it in terms, and so that's the sustaining order. But if you're looking at it in terms of the formative order of the lightning flash, the Gimel is the key. And so though Gimel isn't a diagonal pathway, if you treat it as such, it will equal 868, which is the only word in Hebrew that I know of that equals 868 in Gematria happens to be the word that is used in the first line of the Sefer Yetzirah for the pathways themselves. So mystical pathways is the value of the pathways of the diagonal with the Gimel. And so that's the meaning of the Masonic G, as far as I can tell. And that's why the High Priestess, that it corresponds to Gimel, has Yachin and Boaz on both sides of her with the C behind her, because it's all about the emanated flow. And so There's the different gateways for the Eon to move through. So if you arrange, like if you were to look at the Arcana, if you're looking at that arrangement normal, you'll see Aleph on one side and Lamed on the other. If you just put things in terms of the order of the Hebrew letters and ignore the Roman numerals, right? That's the straightforward arrangement of 11 on the top and 11 on the bottom. And so that's Elohim, that's El. So that's like Liber Al, you say the book of the law, right? That A-L, you know, Christopher Lloyd saying, you can just call me Al, and Angels in the Outfield, to the guy who ends up walking across that pathway between Chesed and Gevorah in the walk, with his name Joseph Gordon Levitz or whatever. But yeah, so there's these two distinct orders. One is the formative and one is the sustaining. The sustaining order is like everything's equal. The formative order, it's ultimately equal, yes, but it's actually communicating the way that things come into form. And that's why the text that I'm looking at is emphasizing right and left brain. So it's saying that the left literally came from the right. And so the meaning is inherent. So like when we're talking about synchronicity in the truest sense comes first. And then everything else is that's the foundation. And then the thing that's extending from that foundation, which is the left side of the brain, can't acknowledge it in completeness where it's coming from, because it's all. That's the meaning of shutting down hell. That's why the fucking discovery in 2010, the year we made contact, goes into the eye of Jupiter, is because that's literally Chesed. So you have Mars across from Chesed. So Mars is Hal. Chesed is Jupiter.
Right.
It was, yeah, pretty crazy, huh?
Wow.
Okay. That's why if you add up the gematria for all the titles in 2001, they'll total 777.
Shit, really?
Really. In simple English gematria.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So Dawn of Man, Jupiter Mission 18 months later, and Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite, that totals 777. And then it moves in the order of the formative pathways. And so you're looking at the lightning flash being represented. But it all comes down to that, to Tet, which is lust, which is our strength, or Oz. Oz 77, that's the pathway between Gevorah and Chesed. And so this is like Hillary's image, that she has the H with the fucking... the arrow, the red arrow, going to the right. It's pretty straightforward.
Are you saying the movement from the left side to the right side across that high priestess Gimel right. pathway?
Because what it's talking about is that the left is going to want to swallow the right.
Ugh.
And so it's gone all this way through severity. And then when it gets to the apex of it, when it reaches its crescendo, it's like, okay, I'm going to get the other side. And when it goes to, because it came from the other side, and because the other side is its foundation, then it gets swallowed up by the thing that it thought it was going to swallow. And then that's like the ex machina of the situation. That's the flying pig. That's the black swan. That's what I was saying to Will. So it's the end of the... Dark crystal and Keter and Tiferet. It's because they're treating a pathway that's not a diagonal pathway as if it were, and that's the sacrifice. And it's a cross, so you have a double cross. You have the cross of Dalet as the empress crossing with the high priestess, so the pathway between Chochmah and Bina, and then they're two different dimensions, and so we can't see the other dimension through, you know, our normal. Like the way that we relate to things, because it doesn't stand out in space in the same way. And so then below you have Tet. So it's this double cross there. I think that that might be the meaning of the Templar double cross. I wonder if Jason has any other ideas around that. But yeah.
I feel you, man. I feel you.
Nabisco, you know what I'm saying? You look closely at an Oreo cookie, it's totally Templar symbolism all over it.
Isn't an Oreo a triple cross, like the Hierophant staff, or no?
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
I've looked at Nabisco in a long time, but...
I don't know. Just know it's just loaded with the Templar little crosses, and then it's got that, too. But, you know, the point is there's these two orders, and they coexist. And one you'd relate to is you're like, oh, that's balance. And then the other one reveals what the real balance is and that it's not what we would think. And as far as I can tell, too, this is a good reconciliation of like love is the law, love under will. Because you say the will is above the love, but it depends upon the love. Like one's coming from the other. And it seems like that's like kind of the moral of the Zohar in a way. It's like that's what the redemption amounts to, is this, you know, the meaning of that something is depending on something and it's denying its dependence. And in the end, it can't help but work itself out because of the way that it comes into form. It's why Keter has two right sides. I don't know if that was helpful or not for your question, but in terms of the attributions, I mean, the attributions changed in specific ways. We went from one gate to the ninth gate. So Tet is the ninth. And so that's why the ninth pathway is that pathway of Leo. And then if you arrange the cards that way, if you move over all the letters as that circle, you know, or the vesica, then because he has Tet there anyway. So if you just move over everything else, then you have Resh as a cross. And so Resh and Tet, that's the sun and Leo. I mean, come on. Give me a break. Babylon.
I thank you so much for expounding upon that. I will probably, if you're okay with it, I'm probably just going to private message you and ask you for, I don't know, maybe like links or whatever. There's a lot to unpack here, and I'm not going to pretend like I completely understand all of that, but I would really like to. So if you're willing,
I have the prophecy in longhand. I haven't transcribed it yet into. I've been working on it for over a year now, that particular text. So I've been transcribing the 2nd century in Aramaic and the commentary on it from like the 15th century from the Hebrew.
Oh.
And so, but yeah, it tells this whole story and it gives exact dates. And so it includes the date of when the Zohar will become public. It includes the two First World Wars, and it includes it includes 9/11 with a full explanation of the why, which is pretty heavy.
If I can just pause you guys there for 1 second. So I know Jason, I don't know if you hold to this super tightly or not, but you know, you've always struck me as someone who wants to go back to original sources as much as possible. And David, same way, you would sort of always make the distinction of you have your European occultists versus your traditional Judaic mysteries of how they would have laid things out and how things.
Which is a mix for them too, don't get me wrong.
What's that?
It's a mix for them too.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's like, so
yeah,
when
like, with
you have
everything all at once, you know? Yeah.
Say again?
Well, it's just everything all at once. You have so many people coming from different places simultaneously in all ages. And so, like, I'd speak to specific, rabbis and things, and they state very blatantly what their understandings and intentions are. And you get the idea that they're looking to reconcile this tree. Like, they relate to it as something that, you know, is going to undergo this shift or a mutation, and that we're literally going to experience that mutation physically. I mean, it seems to be describing that the two hemispheres of our brain are actually going to become one, and that as a result, we'll be relating to our perceptions in a completely different way.
It's funny because, this just as a quick tangent, the movie poster for Wonderwall, if you look at it, I realize, again, when I'm just always thinking, oh, it's popping in my head, I was in the shower, was it's literally representing the left and right hemispheres of the brain. It's, and so there's, okay, if anyone looks, you'll see it's like a man. So the left side is very black and white. It's like a man, all in, is totally monochrome. He's like dressed in, you know, a sort of like tuxedo and top hat type thing. I'm just doing this from memory. But then on the other side, you have like this sort of like, very, like Indian, essentially like orgiastic, colorful nudity, like paradise, Eden, however you want to describe that. and he's on one side of the wall and the paradise is on the other. And that there was a story that the guy who originally painted it painted this just this brick wall. And
oh, I see now, yeah.
And someone, I forget who it was.
That's the album.
Oh, okay, it's the album cover. And one of the, I don't know, I'd have to look up to remember who it was, but someone, like, got into an argument with him and made him remove a single brick.
Wow.
Just to represent that the guy could have hope of reaching the other side of the wall, right?
That's just another brick in the...
Well, right. And then when you're saying, right, this idea of merging the two hemispheres, that's just an interesting little aside.
It just makes me want to listen to this album with the film The Wall now.
Yeah, yeah.
We already got it thick as a brick in the wall.
So do you think there's any correlation perhaps between, say, as Kay was some of the idea of the planetary arrangements have shifted, and Jason, we were in Boise, you were talking a lot about the idea of the pole star as being something, a sort of interesting resonator for you at the moment. And of course, over periods of time, literally, like, astrologically, the pole star will change, right? And you have this sort of, or like, then you have things like precession of the equinox and so on. Do you guys see any perhaps correlation between a shifting in planetary alignments? Is this just ideology? Or David, when you said, we'll feel this experientially, almost like with each aeon, both a literal change in the astrology as well as a sort of symbolic corresponding change in the alignments. Is there anything like that speak to you guys?
Jason?
I see the pole star as being kind of a symbolic kind of thing and not directly related to astrological themes, but except in a sort of analogous kind of way. So it's not about like the actual stars, but more like their symbolic import in like the way that every place is the same as another place when seen in a certain way. So North Korea and South Korea are the same as like North America and South America, or something like that.
Are the continents on the moon are the same as the continents on the moon?
Right, and so
looks
I mean,
like continents. I've been turned on the
moon. This is just really hard to explain, so I'm sorry. But like, take the Wonderwall, where like that guy on the left could be Donald Trump, and the place on the right could be Mexico.
Right.
Totally, and they're gonna pay for that wall.
Right. Right.
We'll give them one hole in it so they can have hope. That's fucked up. So in regards to the supernal spherot, right, you're asking for attributions. But Keter, all emphasis seems to be laid on Sirius, because the first pathway that extends from Keter to Chochmah is Aleph, right, for the Europeans. But they're telling you to do this in the text that I'm looking at, because they're emphasizing all the pathways that are above the terrestrial, the nine pathways, and how they relate to Yud, Yud-Heh-Vav, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. But basically, that you can if you arrange those three letters in every possible combination, you end up with nine combinations total or whatever. And there's this whole thing with the 9 and the 13, because you have 13 pathways left over after the 9, and you add them all together, and you get 22. And so there's this whole thing of, you know, 12 plus 1 or whatever. But the point is that Barak and Abarak. So Abarak is the word for Sirius in Hebrew, which is just Barak with an Aleph. But Barak is lightning. And you have lightning and Sirius directly connected. And the first movement of the lightning flash as it extends down the tree from Keter is the Aleph, which that's the thing. So you add or remove the Aleph. That's your 111, and it determines the rest, because everything follows from the first emanation. So
right. So you've got like Polaris is like the actual pole star, and then you've got Sirius as kind of a symbolic kind of pole star.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got these two kind of things, and then that's why you got to have to like approach it from like an intuitive, non-rational kind of way to get anywhere with it, as you said about disconnecting Hal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about Hal, because Hal is literally Freudian slip. So Gevorah is literally described as a red eye in all sorts of text, and that's tripping me out. I'm like, really? Really?
Because nice creations.
Yeah, what Crowley did is he switched Toddy out with Hay. So Hay became the star. But what he did was so the Empress and the Emperor would be looking right at each other. But as it exists now, when the Empress is going to look at her partner, right, the lovers, she's actually looking at the star, who's turned, her body is turned towards her in the star, but her head is turned away, and it's looking up at the emanated flow. And in the arrangement, if you align them, then you'll see that death is actually what we call death. It was the only unnamed major arcana in Marseille Tarot, but it is moving at a diagonal from the emanated flow. So if you ever see that line of that looks kind of like fractally of the spirits, you know, in the death card in Crowley's deck, in the Thoth deck, that connects with the flow that is being poured from the star card. And so the thing is that Tsadi is a fish hook. And so he put the fish hook right next to the mouth of the tower. So pay means mouth. And so you have, and then you have death is the fish. And so you have this thing going where fucking you have a hook of the Emperor being connected to the tower, and then the Emperor then is Mars, or is Aries, and the tower is Mars, and Mars, Aries is Mars, like, you know what I'm saying? Those correspond, and so the two get linked together, and so that's the cycle of Tisha B'Av that's put in place. You're literally looking at a Valis loop of time of the eon and how it plays out. But what is being emphasized of why this event is different from the previous ones of the destruction of the towers is that the whole world is watching it. Not only that, but they've watching it to more than they've ever watched anything. And so more people viewed the towers being destroyed than they have any event in history on television and the computer.
Is that actually explicitly expressed in the prophecy you're talking about, the idea of?
Yeah, it's talking about that the whole world sees it.
So it goes back to Katz's Stargate idea of everyone focusing on, of all consciousness being focused on a single event.
Right. Basically, yeah.
Forum for him to explain all of this fully.
What's that?
I think this is the perfect time for you to explain all of the prophecy, isn't it?
Well, I'm doing what I can. Yeah, I mean, it's extensive. Okay. And then every time I go, there's another piece, and they're all big pieces. And so I'm like, oh, well, you know, it's like, we sit down to study and this shit gets dropped and I'm like, oh my god, it's total confirmation of something, but there's still unknown elements. But
I'll keep talking, I'm listening.
Yeah, well, it's basically describing these three world wars and why these wars are different from all other wars, because they're global. And it's saying that before these buildings get destroyed in this nation that needs to be purified, right, that's connected to Israel, even though it's not Israel. And so it's saying that these buildings collapse, three buildings and a palace, and 68 days after this event, that nation shows up at the border of every nation around the world to impose corrupt laws. It says that. And so 68 days after 9/11 was the day that the TSA was established. I checked. And so seems to be predicting the TSA as well. But it's saying, and then it goes on to describe the one world government, the eye, the basically worship of an eye, another god. So they're instead of having the regular name with the Aleph on one side and the Lamed on the other, which would be a gate, you know, it's a stargate. But instead of way between Gevorah and Chesed. And so this all connects to what Crowley did as well. They're like, I can't tell if Crowley like knew of this in the Zohar and is like playing it out, or if it's literally like, you know, I don't know where the line is, but it's tripping me the fuck out. So, the Third World War is different than the previous two because the soldiers who are standing there can see through the veil. So before they were fooled, and now information and everything reaches a crescendo where you're literally seeing the thing for what it is. Like it's saying 2,000 years ago when the temple was destroyed, nobody, just who was there is who saw it. Now it's like the whole world sees it, you know, and can see through an illusion. It's pretty nuts. You guys still there?
I can't help but think of, have you ever been to like, you know, either like some sort of political event or protest or whatever, where like when police are acting out and, like, you know, basically arresting somebody or beating somebody up or whatever.
The whole world is watching.
Exactly. You know where I was, right.
That's what they said in Chicago, yeah.
Yeah, so people just start shouting that. And, you know, in one respect, obviously there are plenty of people who aren't paying attention, but there's something amazing about that as a mantra of sorts. Because it's in many ways, it is certainly true.
Right. Yeah, and it takes, you notice that there's been this lag time every time an event happens, but because things increase, like, they doctored the Zapruder film, and it's so obvious. You can see the way that they sped up the car, which was going much slower and things when you do the cross comparisons with the other film and stuff. And it's like, you know, you can take every station on 9/11, and you can see how they had the same shots, but with different weather and shit. You know, we watched buildings disintegrate into dust using some crazy technology. They're hit with a fucking missile and, you know, that would look like a plane. And then that wasn't even what took them down. Whatever took them down was some crazy technology. You can't, like, it doesn't follow any rule according to any regular demolition, and it doesn't follow anything according to the official story. It's something else. And it's totally.
I thought it was the emanating flow.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It just—it seems like there's some crazy technology that exists, and that it's like so in our face, you know. Yeah, I was really liking that Wonder Woman comic with the black lightning flash hitting the two towers. That was pretty groovy. Jesus fuck. Because it's Diana, you know. But you got Diana, Artemis, and that whole thing of like Diana's mirror and Nemi at the Golden Bough and the sacrifice and all of that. It's just, it's very straight, you know. The idea is that the left is a mirror of the right, but really what it's looking at is a reflection of itself.
And you know, David,
its own, yeah.
David, there's a, I mean, there's, I don't, it's rather common, but there's a belief that Donald Trump is actually sort of a Trojan horse from Hillary Clinton and the left. So it kind of, I mean, it's interesting how that theory sort of is example of what you're saying. Like, the Clintons knew Donald Trump for a long time.
Yeah, I'm about to tear my face off. I'm like, it's 2016, the 16, the tower, Trump, yeah. Trump tower, the Trump card.
Oh, it's insane.
The fucking Trump. I mean, I'm sure everybody sees this. The,
yeah.
You know, but what the fuck? Seriously. It's insane. And his mouth, too, that his mouth is the focus, and pay, mouth, you know?
Douglas Bowles isn't on this call, but he's been, like, all over the Trump Tower as the Trump card for a while. It's really crazy to watch that be exemplified in everything we're seeing.
Yeah, and then you got fucking Biff from Back to the Future. Yeah, I don't get it. The whole thing with, like, poor people, I don't want to go into a whole political thing, but just to say really quickly, poor people voting for Donald Trump, that is like Sarah Silverman's, you know, Jewish people driving German cars. It's the opposite of FUBU. It's like Patty Hearst siding with her kidnappers. I don't get it.
There's a really great book written about that called Deer Hunting with Jesus, and it basically profiles, like, predominantly poor white Southerners and ask the question, why do these people support these right-wing fascists when in fact they're not they're not getting put in office to vote to promote their interests at all. So it's this right. paradoxical thing, right? So I think that's been the best deconstruction ever. And he doesn't say explicitly in the book, but since reading that some years back, I've stumbled across other sort of like social psychology literature, especially like Eric Fromm or even like Wilhelm Reich. He represented a lot of those ideas and spoke of the psychological underpinnings without saying explicitly, "This I'm using psychology to profile these people." So it's very, very, it's one of the best pieces of political science ever written. And the guy that wrote it's amazing. But that's, I know, it's like, why? But when you understand, like, even Pavlov's experiments with dogs, you push them into an extreme, physically or socioeconomically or whatever, and then all of a sudden they start acting totally bizarre, totally paradoxically reverse to what you would think. So in the same way, humans, I mean, yes, humans are transcendent in a way and we're different and blah, blah, blah. But we're also very animal, and that's just a law. That's just a rule.
Yeah. You can say that again.
Yeah, I think it's a big mistake to assume that We are not. So, okay, sorry, Jen. I'm agreeing with your point, is to say, yes, we are in many ways, quote-unquote, smarter than that, but also, yes, that, like, I think evidence has borne out again and again and again that we are, we are pretty predictable, and our behavior has been mapped out enough that obviously they can get us, and the they, I don't mean that like in a grand conspiracy sense, but I mean everything from advertisers getting us to buy the right cup of coffee or the right brand of cigarettes to voting.
That's a grand conspiracy sense.
Yeah, well, no, I'm saying, I don't mean, right, precisely. It's like even the on the surface.
You're not talking about the OCL and Freemasons. You're saying just on every chain through the whole thing. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a massive in-your-face, on the surface, exposed, completely explicit conspiracy, an institutional conspiracy to control the minds, not in like a MK Ultra sort of way, but in a, you know, again, you know, as a good consumer or a good voter or a good anything. That to me seems there's no debate there.
May I?
Yeah.
Okay, so, you guys are talking about 9/11 as being, I guess, the most, not necessarily watched, but the most seen worldwide event that has taken place. And then, like, that takes me back to, I don't know if, how many of you have seen that documentary, The Mindscapes of Alan Moore. But, yeah. You know, he's talking about at some point in the documentary that, you know, advertisers are sort of like, in a way, the modern day black magicians, because they can sort of, get people to see. I'm going to probably bungle what he was saying, but
it's like sigil magic, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. And so get people to think the same thoughts at the same time, that sort of thing. And so like 9/11 would be like, I mean, that would be advertising on a massive scale, because you have all of the, you know, I feel like, I don't want to speak for anybody, but it sort of seems like you guys kind of get that, you know, the news agencies, like, you know, shit is scripted, and everybody's basically reading off of the same, the same script. And so when you have an event like that, though, where it's such a global event, and to get everyone thinking the same thing at the same time, like, what kind of, I don't know, like, what sort of magnitude of black magic is that?
Right. It's out of control. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an author named John Michael Greer. He's a practicing druid, but he's also, like, a political activist type. And he, in one of his books, he was basically viewing society through, again, a magical lens, and he would describe sort of like propaganda as that is magic, like we're just saying, but he calls what the Matrix we're living in a magician state, or sort of like these magician states. Even though the nation state is sort of obsolete, we still pay lip service to it. So we live in these magician states that are ruled by magic, which has always just been, going back to the Alan Moore documentary, he puts it on the table saying, it's just, magic has always been changing people's consciousness and basically mind control, one way or another. Or, I mean, mind control is one manifestation of it. It's not always about that. It's about motive. But, that's a great movie. I love it. I've watched that documentary, leaving, you know, Alan Moore's character in out of it. But it's just like that documentary, it's so valuable. There's so much, it covers so much ground. Yep. And he is a very clear-headed person.
Mm-hmm.
And there's I'm glad that you got a chance to see it, because I know John and I have discussed this at pretty great length, but there's another sort of element in there where he talks about let's say you're a satirist, it doesn't have to be like satire, but like the idea of hexing someone or putting a curse on someone. You know, we were talking about Dante's Inferno not long ago, and this idea that like Dante puts his like political opponents in these rings of hell just because they pissed him off or he disagreed with them or whatever, and half of these people history would have forgotten, except for the fact that they're known as some schmuck in hell for being a dick at some point to Dante, right? And in that, and Alan Moore makes this point that if you're a good writer, you can curse someone that for, you know, multiple generations, that family's name is essentially slandered or mocked or any of these things, that you can literally curse someone, as in writing and cursing, that this is a linguistic or a literary tool. And I can't help but think of that as, again, in the same respect, that this is spin, right? This is what a spin doctor does, is you control who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. And even in an artistic sense, it kind of goes back to the old adage that all art is propaganda, that, you know, sort of taking the good and the bad labels off of it, it's like even someone like that we might agree with or whatever, them making a laughing stock out of this person is really, I don't know, at its root, not very different than someone, you know, a Wall Street executive advertising firm painting a political opponent as a villain or something.
Right.
Right. I think he's talking about Elmore is talking the difference between a curse and a hex. It's like a hex, well, you get a clubbed foot or something, worst case. But
right.
The satire, it poisons the well of social relations. I mean, when you really think about what human existence is, it's nothing but relations with your others in the world. It's not an isolated occurrence. So that itself gets to the heart of like all human meaning and value. And it really is. It can be really powerful. It's the most powerful thing. I mean, that's why we're also interested in it, one way or another.
So why is Bill and Eyes Wide Shut? I was thinking it's because he's the vice.
You gotta say again,
like, David, oh, if you're getting the bill. What's that?
You cut out for me. I don't know if David's cutting out for
us. I was saying that, for a second. Like, Bill Hartford in Eyes Wide Shut, he's Bill because he's the price we pay.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's like, at what sacrifice can the city be born, you know? It's like, that's the whole in the dynamic of things, because they're being manipulated from the top down, and it's showing how our relationship to ourselves and the way that we, our whole structure of living is like being manipulated in this.
Well, it's predicated on the sacrifice of the beauty queen,
right?
And so Healy's inevitably going to get punished for that and have to pay that bill,
right?
That's the doctor bill of physician heal thyself.
Things in this way, and we're manipulating the tree to how we, you know, want to use the energy. You know, it's like. Yeah, there's like, who's taking on the cost of that? But somebody like that, you know, like every man or whatever, you know, and the every woman, you know, it's like Nicole Kidman's character is like every woman in a sense. I mean, that happens in a lot of things where things get demonstrated that way. It's like Fondo and Liz or something, but you know.
Well, like like so many Kubrick movies, it shows like, you know, Eyes Wide Shut is not as explicit as what. As embodying something like fascism, but I mean, it's like the great disparities in wealth and so on and so forth, and type of like real politics, social control, power politic type stuff. I mean that is fascism 101. And so Kubrick again is, yeah, like you just said, he's talking about it, and you see it in their personal life where, you know, as much as they give the superficial appearance of this great marriage, there's all kinds of really just interpersonal things that are not right between them, and they're repressed, and it's very Freudian and analytical, like.
Right, but the whole thing centers around a murder. So you have this murder, and then you have him making a correlation. So Bill sees the newspaper, he sees what happened, he's like, there's a connection. He sees the meaning. And all the whole fucking conversation with Sidney Pollack at the end, where he's imitating the cane, but he's using the ball on the pool table, you know? That whole thing, it's like, he's trying to convince him that the correlation that he sees doesn't imply causation. And so he's like, there's a synchronicity, and it has these implications. And he's like, no, they just happen to be coexisting. And it's like,
Well, the big revelation with this movie was where the splitting in two of the $100 bill, and then the of the sacrifice of the girl in the newspaper, like exactly synchronized. If you put the films back to front or something, and you, did you see that article?
No, I don't know what you're
talking
about.
What's that? I'm sorry. Yeah.
If you lay the movie like back to front.
In the same way as John Fell Ryan did with The Shining?
Right.
Which I sent him a message asking him to do that.
Right. The spot where he tears the $100 bill in half is the same as the place with the newspaper. And so then you've got the bill again as Dr. Bill, and you've got the tearing in half of the money corresponding again with the dead beauty queen. As the central sacrifice in the film.
Jason, like, can you find that link?
Yeah, I got it here.
Okay.
I'm not trying to bring up the chat window here on this thing.
Hey, if you...
Like, on Mac Skype, there is no chat window at all.
Oh, really?
So if somebody chats to me, it'll open up. It's really weird.
Yeah, I don't have one anymore on this computer. I don't know what's going on, but, yeah.
I was thinking a lot about the trial of Paris in the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's a direct correlation. I haven't really put any thought into this, but it's interesting as you're mentioning Eyes Wide Shut, you know, sort of in one respect, he is going through a similar sort of thing, right? Again, I don't know if there's a direct one-to-one correlation there, but what do you... Does that speak to you at all, or also, like, I don't know, like, in a purely esoteric reading of it, and we don't have to go Eyes Wide Shut route, what are your thoughts on the sort of moral of that story?
Well, there's the whole thing for me is all about these two eyes, and they're like, in Egyptian mysticism, they'd be like the eyes of Pharaoh, right? So you have the eye of Ra, and you have the eye of Thoth, like, there's, like, eye of Horus or whatever, but it's that you have the sun and the moon. And so when you're looking at the Tarot Arcana, right, you're literally looking at a representation of the reflection in the moon of the sun. And so they're possibly communicate what the fuck is going on. And, you know, like that, as far as I can tell, it's like every single element all the way through is as blatant and in your face as you can possibly be, because they tell you, you know, like that Freemasonry and the OTO connect. They left their signature at Ground Zero as the Oculus. Like that giant fucking eye that's a dove, the Vesica dove. Give me a break, right? I mean, come on. Is it you guys know what I'm talking about? Hello?
Hey, yeah. go back 1 minute.
The OTO, the, the Vesica symbol for the OTO with the dove, with the chalice, how that's like overtly in the Oculus at Ground Zero, that giant artistic structure that opens one time out of the year on 9/11 for the duration between when the planes hit the building and when they collapsed, or excuse me, disintegrated.
Oh, I haven't seen that there's something that they put that inside that.
Oh, you haven't? No, I mean that's what, because you're looking at a giant Vesica and they're telling you it's a white dove. And so I'm like, a Vesica and a dove? What does that make you think of? As far as I can tell, it's a signature from the OTO. But it wouldn't be necessarily like the OTO that everybody knows and loves. It would be the higher ranks, which we all know are Tantra based, and that what's being communicated in Eyes Wide Shut, if you're, what secret society is that? Who are those people? Like, though, that's the levels that are latched onto the OTO, that are connected, that latched onto Freemasonry. It's still the same thing as, like, you know, Proofs of a Conspiracy, the Illuminati book from the late 1700s, you know, it's like that whole idea of infiltration. It's like, these are the people that infiltrated, but those are real grades. The only reason I know about this prophecy in the Zohar is because of Leo Zagami. Not that I resonate and agree with everything that the dude says, you know, but that Italian whistleblower guy, he shows documentation for where the OTO and Freemasonry connect in his Project Camelot thing. And the thing was, is that that other part checked out. I mean, that was, you know, that's the proof is in the thing, you know, I mean, it's right fucking there. But yeah, it's, you know, there's a, I think that there's a purpose for everything, including ignorance. And that's like a weird place to come to. Like, I feel like there's that it's aiding in the thing in and of itself somehow. It's like, there's like in the unveiling, it's necessary that there be these eyes that are wide shut in order for the thing to really be transformative or evolutionary, you know, dimensionally, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's just escapism or something, but I'm tripping on that.
Well, there's a concept in evolutionary theory. It's, like random walking and this sort of thing. And also you see this in certain species like ants or even in humans, and not to say we're automatons completely, but mistakes are what drive everything. It's a bunch of people just going out and exploring what feels right to them, right? And trying to get in touch with whatever your instinct is, because obviously we're way out of touch with our instincts as Western people. So yeah, in that sense, it's like, I think everything we do is evolutionary in some sense. And so there's really no, like, I mean, you talk about escapism. Look at regular society, that we would be labeled as, say, outsiders of or whatever, or critiquers of. I mean, that is the embodiment of insanity. And I'm supposed to, like, and I'm supposed to feel bad about my escapism or my neuroses. It's hypocritical. So I don't.
All right, well, I'm neurotic as fuck. I don't know about
you. I mean, we all are. No shit. But it's like, compared to other people's normal neuroses, I'll take my freak neuroses over normal any day.
Okay, fair enough. Any thoughts, any ideas? Apparently we have 8 people in this call, and all I hear is myself.
Because we never had you on one of these, I don't think.
Yeah, no, we've done this.
So we're happy to have you talk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool, thanks, guys.
Well, Jason, did you mind if you have any thoughts? Did you like I said, like we have the idea of like the three graces playing out at multiple sort of sync gatherings, right? But then something occurred to me is, I don't know if Hannah, I hope you can hear us. So Hannah, right, me, Kaylee, and Hannah drove out together, and she had an apple, and one day I said to her something like, oh, are you the apple, you're holding the apple, are you Eve, or are you Eris, or are you Snow White? Like, what archetype are you embodying there with that apple? Because she would always have an apple with her. And, then I ended up putting up, I didn't tell anybody about this, it was just something I realized, I ended up putting up the Chris Knowles Always Record from Hannah's iPad, and in it he talks about that he had written a screenplay that got stolen, and we just sort of like, we talk about it a little bit, and like then we kind of, but he doesn't say the names. And then when I was going to put the links up, I remembered what the names were. And there was, his screenplay was called Snow. And it was about basically an adaptation of Snow White. And the movie that got made was a movie called Hannah.
Yeah, I talked about that movie in relationship to The Lovely Bones, which is the classic Persephone myth.
Mm.
As I may have mentioned before.
Yeah.
Granted is like the apple.
Say again?
With Demeter, when she leaves
right.
the underworld, is that she gets the pomegranate from Hades, that that's like the apple?
Yes. I definitely favor Snow White because there's some similarity to some of my old posts in that respect.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I feel like, whatever. I mean, I'm just, like, I'm, you know, playing pin the archetype on the person is kind of an unfair thing to do, but I can't help but playing that game, right? Because I'm trying to, you know, basically you're all players in my own mystery play, so whatever, right?
we were looking at the Wonderwall image with the wall. Apple Records. Who remembers where Apple Records came from, what they're named after?
Oh, I don't remember.
Fucking Son of Man, the painting with the guy with the apple head, the green apple head, with the little hat that was the basis of Peter Sellers' character being there.
Oh, yeah, the Magritte painting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just, that's really weird that it's, you know, Son of Man.
Sounds good.
Okay. Let's see if I can add this guy, and then add this person.
Okay, this seems to be working. Sorry about that. I'm really not sure what happened.
Hello.
Hey, trying to add everyone back.
You know, screws fall all the time. The world's in a perfect place.
Alan, you sound like a hacker. What are you doing when you type so fast? Huh? You're like coding some serious shit.
He just has rodents in his house. That's all I'm doing. Chewing on the power cord.
It's like, you're the rat.
All right.
Bye, Doc.
I was afraid of that.
Hey, Doug. So here's Kaylee just sent me a message.
Oh, I did. Because
I've been trying to add her. It's not working. She said, FYI, I'm not connected to Doug. Can you try adding this contact? I just put in the Skype here.
Tell her she's going to microwave that burrito to put holes in the wrapper because they explode. Sorry.
Holes in the microwave? What?
No, holes in the wrapper of the burrito if you're going to microwave it at the 7-Eleven. The jalapeno drop.
Is there a reference I'm missing here?
Yeah, there is. It's fine. It's when the guy goes into the 7-Eleven and then he's describing the guy who was in there before him, and he tells him like his crazy mystical trip that he's on. The guy walks in and it's like super profound, and he's like, "Oh, what did you say to that?" And he was like, "I told him if he's going to microwave that burrito to poke holes in the wrapper because they explode, and I'm tired of cleaning up your little burrito dunes."
What movie is this from?
Waking Life. Waking Life is like, because, you know, in Waking Life, when the director gives the talk, Richard Linklater, he gives the talk about Philip K. Dick and the thing with the Book of Acts, and he's like, I never read the Book of Acts, and he goes and he meets, he's like going to help this guy with his vehicle, and he gives him, and he realizes that the guy needed a ride when he went back to his house, so he goes back and he picks him up, and then he talks to his priest about it, and the priest was like, oh, you're describing the Book of Acts, and then it was this for Philip K. Dick, and so it turned out that the characters in his real life experience had the same name as the characters in the Book of Acts, and so for this, that was where he got his Valis loop idea, was that we're reliving this time, but the director makes the distinction, and he goes, it's no more whatever it was AD that the Book of Acts was, as it is 2001, and here we are in this loop, you know, he's describing the thing. But of all the times, it's like that film came out, you know, what, very shortly before 9/11, right? Or something. I mean,
right,
it was like
the Tisha B'Av loop of the destruction of the temple.
Right. He's totally talking about Tisha B'Av, yeah. And so, but that's the point, is like the Valis loop ties into Tisha B'Av directly. And that's like, that would, with all the diagonal pathways and everything the way that they are and how the Klipa entered through Gevura, it would work if it wasn't for this.
Can everyone else hear David? Because I lost him.
Yeah.
I can't.
I feel like maybe we're just slightly more grounded than David is. You know? Sometimes the ethereal flows just drift off. Is that what happens? He's coming back. He'll still be talking, too.
David's lost in some space oddity.
So, Jason, did you have a moral of the story of the Trial of Paris? Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, it's about he selects physical beauty instead of intellectual beauty, and thus condemns the Trojans to an eternal war. And that's what Helen signifies, is material beauty. Whereas Penelope would be the philosophical ideal of beauty, according to the Neoplatonic school of philosophy, of course. And in like Neoplatonism, they had this all figured out, and they wrote about it and the esoteric meanings of these little myths. So
but that,
according to the
books. But no, I guess for me, so here's what I guess what I'm saying by that, though, is that there's a third choice.
Right.
Oh. In the mythological tarot deck, they have that spelled out, and it's Aphrodite. I don't remember who it is.
Isn't it Aphrodite, Athena, and I want to say it's Hera.
Yeah, that sounds right. But I think he does pick superficiality.
But, no, right. But I guess, okay, here's what I'm saying. Let me just be explicit with my question. What the fuck, like... and this probably shows my ignorance in this way of recognizing beauty. What is the beauty of Hera? Or like what would that
isn't she the matron, you know, like the mother?
Right.
Where's the beauty?
Okay.
Let me look it up in my little. Or not. Go on.
Oh, yeah. I'm like I said. I just it was so basically. I just found myself thinking. I found myself thinking about this with the thing of the three graces, thing of the three cups, thing of stuff. And then I thought, oh, the apple made me think about this other aspect. And then I was just like, you know, maybe I'm not understanding what's the missing third element there? Like when you said physical beauty, intellectual beauty, what would you... And obviously, and then you're relating in, because now we have these other factors. It's not just those three goddesses, but you also have Eris involved, and you also have Helen of Troy involved. Right,
well,
so
according to Thomas Taylor here, Juno is the fountain of virtues, and Minerva is the fountain of nature.
Oh, that's it. I just have no virtues. Okay,
so,
cool.
Yeah. Like marital virtue, I suppose.
I'm just out of touch with my virtues. I was just trying to figure out what I was missing. Sorry. It was just like when I... Because I think Kaylee and Hannah and I were in the car. I mentioned the Trial of Paris, and then I was trying to remember who the third goddess was. And I was like, I know Aphrodite and Athena. And I was like, who's the third goddess? And I was like, I think it's Hera or Juno, obviously. And I was like, and then I was like, that, I almost felt like, that can't be right. That's not even a fair competition.
The banquet denotes the supermundane powers of the gods, and on this account they subsist in conjunction with each other. But the golden apple denotes the world, which, on account of its composition from contrary natures, is not improperly said to be thrown by discord or strife. But again, since different gifts are imparted to the world by different gods, they appear to contest with each other for the apple, and a soul living according to the sense, for this is Paris, not perceiving the other powers of the universe, asserts that the apple is alone the beauty of Venus. So, according to Mr. Thomas Taylor, both of the other goddesses would be preferable to Venus alone.
Gotcha. Okay.
But of course, I saw your four different girls as being the entire Tetragrammaton, Yahe, Valhe.
Okay. But so, and the fifth, like I said, you know, if you think of it that way, there actually are, there's Paris, but there's also five other players involved.
Right.
I don't know. I'm overcomplicating it. It was just, I realized that there was more to meditate on here, and I'm sorry. I'm not coming to this having properly meditated on it. I was sort of just wondering if anyone else had.
So Hera is also associated as like a cow goddess, so she would be, she would also be associated with, like, Hathor, which also is associated with Isis. I don't know. That's all I really wanted to say. I'm sort of, like, reading about this as I... Oh, interesting. Okay. She's also... she's also associated with Hecate. Interesting.
Peacock. But in one respect, it almost, you could easily correspond that to be that each of those three goddesses represent an aspect of Hecate as well.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it was basically like a kind of thought in my mind, and I'm just being explicit here, is to say when we were having this conversation in the car, and I was like, I think it's Hera, but that doesn't make sense. And it was just like, in that moment going, that doesn't make sense, I was like, ooh, that's a blind spot. There's something I'm missing here. You know what I mean? Like, why would that be of...
Why don't you find mom's foxy?
So in my mind, it's again, you go
foxy
going to
mom. You clearly you've never gone to preschool. It's like, ooh, foxy.
Well, it's
mom.
No, because it's not even like, if we were going to like doing a correspondence to Hecate or the triple goddess, it's not even like I would necessarily associate her as like the crone or anything like I guess I'm just. It seems in depictions I don't know. It's really just an interesting, I haven't fully thought it out. It was just there was a glaring blind spot that became obvious to me when I said those words of like, that can't be right. And I was like, well, clearly it's right. And what am I missing? Like there's something in my mind that would do that. And that's it. End of. We don't have to. I just like to put my blind spots on the table for everyone to see.
Sure.
did we lose some people? Did they have to go?
We definitely lost some people. I can't seem to get David back in. And Hannah, I think, was microwaving a burrito or something.
She's probably microwaving a burrito and like eating a pound of gummy bears right now.
So Hannah actually said 17 minutes ago, she said, hey, I'm going to make some coffee and join the conversation in a few minutes. The room is full again, but I can wait. But that's on the other call. so then I'm trying to join them, add them back in here. David, did I actually connect to you this time?
You did. You connected with me. Hey, who knows what'll happen, but yeah.
Look at that. Fuck yeah. We were just talking about MILFs.
MILFs?
Yeah.
Like a MILF, like a cougar?
Famous MILFs.
Oh, the cougar, right.
Of course, if you really think about MILF, it's like, think about it, it's Mom, I Like Fuck. Mom, I Like Fuck. It's like a
Japanese t-shirt.
Because it would be a MILF to... If...
Would you like to make some fuck berserkers?
Oh boy.
We got here singing Olaf Berserker. Come on, man, Berserker.
Is he singing English or Russian?
In English. Come on, Berserker. Girls think sexy. I'll watch what he's gonna sing and watch. It's too funny.
My love for you is like a truck berserker. Would you like some making fuck berserker?
That's fucking funny, man.
Did he say making fuck?
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from Syncbook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.
My love for you is ticking clock, berserker. Would you like to suck my cock, berserker?
That's beautiful, man.